Thank you.
Please let me begin by apologizing for the delay. The Senate DFL caucus was meeting with its governor, and it would have been difficult to leave. And I just would like to say, as long as I'm on that subject, that you know that the session is scheduled at 11 o'clock before our 12 o'clock hearing, and we expect that the agenda of the sessions will be brief up until second deadline, but if it extends past noon, then we will be running into this problem on a regular basis. So what we are doing is trying to make arrangements for an extension of our hearings in the later part of the day in order to complete the work that we try to get scheduled. And we're trying to keep a reasonable amount of work within an hour and a half meeting. So we're hoping that all of you who are here to testify, all of you who come to testify in the future, that you recognize that we're trying to move through as much as we can during the session, so to keep your comments succinct to the point and making the critical messages to us that we need, allowing us time to ask you questions and allowing us to move through the agenda. So with that, I would just say that we do have a room that we do, if we do not get through the agenda during this committee meeting, we can return this evening around 4 or 4:30 to finish the agenda. That is influenced by another meeting, Transportation Committee ending on time. And so with that, we'll try. I hope we can avoid that and move expeditiously through the agenda today. And we'll begin with Senate File 3, Senator Clausen.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 3, which is a health care loan forgiveness proposal. As many of you know, health care is the fastest growing industry in Minnesota. In fact, it's actually outpacing the national average. And with this growth, we are facing a problem in that we're not keeping pace with industry workforce needs. And this is especially true in rural and underserved communities throughout Minnesota. To address this concern, Senate File 3 provides targeted loan forgiveness to healthcare professionals who agree to practice in rural and underserved communities. And this initiative is a result of two legislative actions. And I'm going to turn your attention to a slide here. In 2013, the legislature agreed to study mental health workforce needs. And we had over 30 mental health professionals meeting for 18 months. We conducted 20 community forums and outreach meetings throughout the state. We surveyed over 500 residents and held a mental health summit attended by over 150 professionals. The second initiative that I'll mention is ongoing. The 2014 legislature authorized a two-year health care commission to identify current and anticipated healthcare workforce needs and those shortages, and also to evaluate the effectiveness of incentives to retain a highly skilled workforce. The commission met through the summer and fall of 2014 to develop preliminary recommendations for the 2015 legislature. And both groups recommended expansion of the existing health professionals loan forgiveness program to meet the needs of rural Minnesota and underserved communities. This expansion includes an increased funding allocation and the addition of mental health professionals, public health nurses, and dental therapists to the state loan forgiveness program. At this time, I would like to call upon Mark Schoenbaum, the Director for Rural Health and Primary Care for the Minnesota Department of Health, and Mr. Schoenbaum will identify the health care professional shortages in our state and outline the Minnesota loan forgiveness program.
Welcome, Mr. Schoenbaum. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good afternoon. I'm Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. If you continue on in the presentation, you will come to a series of maps. And these maps show Minnesota's federally designated health professional shortage areas. This designation is certainly not perfect. There is no such thing as a perfect way to look at shortages, but it is widely used, in common circulation. So it does give us a snapshot through one lens of our workforce situation in the state. If you look at the first map, which is about mental health shortages in Minnesota, you can see that almost the entire state is a federally designated mental health shortage area. And I'll just keep moving here unless people have questions. If you turn to the next page, you can see that similarly, almost the entire state is designated as a dental shortage area, especially for the low-income population in all of the colored areas on the map. And if you turn to the following page, you will see a perhaps more spotty but still significant area of the state is designated by the federal government as primary care shortage areas. And we at the health department do this analysis. The federal government actually makes the formal designations. The maps we've seen so far are of greater Minnesota, but if you keep turning the pages there, you will see that we have a similar situation in the Twin Cities, in the central cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. This first Minneapolis-St. Paul map shows those areas that, again, are designated as dental professional shortage areas. And if you turn the page, it actually takes kind of two related maps to capture the picture for primary care in the Twin Cities. The map on the left looks specifically at the physician-to-population ratio for the low-income population. The map on the right, which picks up more of the story, also starts to bring in demographics about not only physician availability, but poverty, low birth weight, the kinds of demographic factors that contribute to health care demand. So that starts to fill in some of the details that Senator Claussen mentioned are reflected in the two recent health workforce reports. I'll now direct your attention. You have a handout in your packet called Loan Forgiveness Program, and tell you a little bit about the program itself. The first page gives you a little background and the budget history of the program, and if you flip it over, you will see on that left-hand column there a list of the occupations that are eligible for loan forgiveness incentives and the areas or conditions or high-need facilities where they must serve to receive those incentives. Putting kind of this page and the slide in front of us side by side, we do know, having looked at this program in a formal evaluations several times over recent years and comparing it to the evaluations that are done nationally of these types of programs, that loan forgiveness does pretty convincingly seem to be an effective strategy to attract health professionals to the area where they are most needed. And not only does it attract them, but following them over the years, both when they are under that obligation and following, many, many of them remain and make a long-term contribution in their communities for 10 and often 20 years. So this program does appear to be one that works.
Turning to the next slide, I'd just like to quickly review. There are three provisions that I'd like to share with you regarding Senate File 3. The first is that increased funding for the Minnesota Loan Forgiveness Program. Secondly, it targets loan forgiveness funds to rural and underserved communities, providing an additional 200 care providers over 4 years to needy communities in our state. And then lastly, we're adding three health professional positions to the loan forgiveness program, and they are the mental health professionals, the public health nurses, and the dental therapists. The next slide you see gives you a little bit of a picture that Mr. Schoenbaugh was talking about. It provides examples of the Minnesota Loan Forgiveness Program and its effect on student debt for selected professions. The chart includes the three professions that I've just mentioned that are being added to the program, the public health nurses, mental health professionals, and dental therapists. And overall, the forgiveness amount after 4 years is right around 60% of the total loan amount for all professional positions. And then the last slide, we just wanted to share with you. This was an article in the Minnesota Daily. It's a very supportive editorial article. And a related story, the first week of the session, Thursday of that week, we rolled out this bill. And later in the day, I had a call from a local television station. They wanted to run a program, a little story about it. By the time I called back the person doing the story, they had been pulled off the story to cover weather in Minnesota. But it was rather interesting. They had already gone over to the Minnesota Dental School, and they had been walking the halls and talking to students who were just excited that they heard about this forgiveness program that we're sharing with you today. With that, I'd like to some testifiers to come forward. First would be Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota.
Welcome, Ms. Abderholden. Would you introduce yourself and begin your testimony?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden with NAMI Minnesota. We're here today to support Senate File 3. We think it's a great idea. As Senator Claussen mentioned, the 2013 legislature directed MNSCU to really look at mental health workforce shortages across our state. They released this wonderful report, which hopefully you all received. You know, I don't often go on and on about a state government report, but this one is one that you really want to read. I think it has some really good recommendations in it. And one thing that they point out is 9 of our 11 regions in our state are actually designated as a mental health professional shortage area. And another point I want to make is it's not just psychiatrists that we're short of, but all mental health professionals, especially in the rural areas. That includes clinical nurse specialists, clinical social workers, marriage and family therapists, licensed professional counselors, psychologists. We just don't have enough of them in the rural parts of our state. We can't have good health if you don't have good mental health, and so I think it's really important that we look at this issue. I'd also point out that even looking at the governor's budget, which really does expand funding for mental health services so that we improve access, we can't improve access unless we have more professionals working in the field. So we think that this recommendation to expand the loan forgiveness program is a good one. It's in the report. We had many people give input to it. Really hope that you support it. And I really want to thank Senator Claussen for his leadership on this issue and his commitment to it.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Senator Claussen, did you have another person you wanted to testify?
We do. We have two people I'd like to introduce at this time. Dr. Catherine Mackin. She is a resident director at the United Family Medicine Clinic. It's actually located on West 7th, perhaps 2 miles from here, and I've had the privilege of visiting with Dr. Mackin and touring the clinic, and she'll share some information about the clinic and her work. And then we also have Dr. Sarah Eisencheck. She is currently doing her residency at the United Family Medicine Clinic. So we could call them forward, please.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Mackin and Ms. Eisencheck.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourselves as you speak for the record.
Sure. I'm Madam Chairperson and members of the committee. I'm Sarah.
And please pull the whatever microphone might be there right up to as close as you can, because we cannot hear you unless you do that.
Okay. Madam Chairperson and member of the committees, I'm Sarah Eisencheck. I'm a third-year resident physician at United Family Medicine. My rural roots run deep. I grew up on a ranch in central Minnesota. I attended the University of Minnesota Medical School in Duluth because of their strong history of training rural primary care providers. During my third year of medical school, I participated in the Rural Physician Associate Program, RPAP, in New London and Wilmer, Minnesota. That's a 9-month rural immersion program where I trained alongside rural primary care providers. I fell in love with the community, and I'm actually hired to join them after I graduate. At At United Family Medicine in St. Paul, we strive to serve the underserved, both in urban and rural settings. As part of our second year of residency, we do 2 months of rural medicine. I trained in Mora for those 2 months and cared for people who sometimes would hike out of the forest and hitchhike into the clinic to see us to get their blood pressure medications. The poverty was remarkable. I, like many of my physician colleagues, have amassed a significant amount of academic debt, over $200,000. A bill like Senate File 3 would help to alleviate some of that financial burden, which certainly influenced a lot of my decisions moving forward. Thank you for your consideration of the bill.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chairman and Committee, my name is Kathleen Mackin. I'm a family medicine physician and director of United Family Medicine Residency for 23, soon to be 24 years. We did start the program in 92 with the clear vision to train people for rural and urban underserved populations. I am happy to tell you that of our first 119 grads, that 40% of them are in rural family medicine and contributing across the state in significant ways. The only other thing that I will mention is that it is really critical that we do have that curricular component in the rural parts of the state, and also that I believe that the fact that United Family Medicine is a federal qualified health center really helps residents and our staff physicians both serve a very needy community as well as be trained to serve people with complexity related to access, related to poverty, related to many social economic issues, in addition to just having had minimal healthcare access. I too support the bill because I know, being a very senior family medicine physician, that these young docs are our present and our future and are very important to health of communities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I would open it at this time for these testifiers. If there are any questions from members of the committee at this time, we can take a few questions now and then open it up for the public to also have testimony for a while on the bill. Are there any questions from committee members at this time? I have one question, seeing none from the others. I did have my attention brought to a concern around, and I think that you are aware of this as well, Senator Clausen, about the population criteria established here as being a community or a city under 15,000 or under. And the issue that I'm hoping you will look at is how they actually plays out in some of the areas of the state. Some of the facilities or the even the federally qualified centers are in communities that are above that number, and there are no cities that meet the criteria in certain parts of the state that would actually meet the criteria for this bill, according to the concerns I'm hearing from some of the rural legislators. Are you familiar with that, and are you in conversations about that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I am aware of that. I think we have 11 communities that fall into that category. I have not had an opportunity to talk to Mr. Schoenbaum about this, but we'll take that under consideration. Certainly look at that. That's part of that rural health loan forgiveness equation, and we'll certainly take a look at that.
I appreciate that. I know that this will be referred to higher ed, so I'll have a chance to hear back from you on what you learned and what you recommend.
Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Clausen, I know this isn't the right committee for discussing it, but I was just curious in terms of Section 4 appropriations, how much money is needed to make a significant difference in this area? I strongly agree with the need. I think it's urgent, and I think it's probably more money than is likely to happen. But what are advocates and you feeling is a thing where we're going to begin to make a difference?
Madam Chair,
Senator Clausen.
Thank you. Senator, I was trying to keep that a secret, knowing that Senator Lori, you know, would be in his committee. But we're looking to place 200 professionals over 4 years in the state. We're looking at $3 million.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Claussen, I'm not sure if this question, well, this question could be for you and maybe Mr. Schoenbaum, too. But did you look in your travels around and all the work that the Governor's Task Force on Child Protection, did you look at the social worker? I know that there's the clinical social worker as part of the mental health, but that is not necessarily all the levels of social worker. And would they be able to tap into this loan forgiveness program?
Senator Claussen.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we're taking the recommendations of the two study groups. Mental health certainly addressed that in their description of a psychiatric social worker. We have not gone beyond that. So we're basically taking the recommendation at this time of the two groups. As I mentioned, the second group that former Representative Huntley and I co-chaired over the summer and fall, we're continuing our work for another year and a half, and so that could be something that we'd further look at.
Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you. Follow-up. Well, Senator Claussen, I do have a bill for social workers and loan forgiveness, and because it's become very apparent in the work of that task force that we have issues with retaining social workers, especially out in rural and deep rural areas.
Thank you.
So,
any further questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Claussen, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I am intrigued and happy to see the inclusion, I understand, on lines 3.5 and 3.6 of including hospitals that would be operating nursing homes. And I'm just wondering if you can clarify exactly, does that mean the nurses are in the nursing homes? What's the exact result of the language that you have in 3.5, 6, and 7?
I'm going to ask Mr. Schoenbaum to come forward. I don't want to misspeak on that. So I'm going to have Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Schoenbaum.
Senator Nelson, good eye on that change in proposed change in the language. The loan forgiveness program, through the priorities that the legislature has set over the years, establishes kind of the high priority areas where the state wants to provide incentives for people to practice. For registered nurses, along the way, they law requires that to receive loan forgiveness, a registered nurse must work in a nursing home or a facility for the developmentally disabled. I think Senator Claussen found during the Workforce Commission process that there are numerous workforce challenges in the long-term care sector, including the pay differential for nurses between nursing homes and hospitals. So the existing limitation in the program that a nurse must only work in a nursing home helps attract and retain nurses in nursing homes, but the commission heard that if there was a little more flexibility so that if there's a combined campus, a nurse could work kind of on both sides, that that might be another aid, another incentive to retain the nurse in that organization while they were receiving loan forgiveness and after. So that's why that's there.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you for actually that flexibility and clarification. We have a great shortage of nurses in our long-term care facilities, and anything we can do to encourage that, I think, is of great need. And then I have one final question, Madam Chair.
Yes, then we will move on to public testimony.
And I'm just wondering, I was looking for the definition of the dental health professional shortage area and the primary care health professional shortage area and the medically underserved areas. And I'm looking at those little insert maps of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I'm just wondering what was the designation or how were you able to put together these particular areas in Minneapolis or St. Paul as being underserved? What kind of metric was used there?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, the criteria are listed on the statewide maps in the preceding pages, the ratios of healthcare providers, and the same criteria are used in urban areas as well.
Thank you. I don't see that on here, but it must be in a different document. Thank you very much.
We're going to move to public testimony right after Senator Benson asks her question. Sorry. I didn't see her hand before I made that announcement.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I could have waited till the end. I was just looking at the findings from MDH research in 2014 and pretty good retention from loan forgiveness. The dentist, there seems to be quite a fall off compared to other categories. And so has there been any review of how we could incent more dentists to stay in these critical areas if they've taken part in the loan forgiveness program?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, the law requires that to receive loan forgiveness, a dentist must agree to provide at least 25% of their visits to medical assistance or sliding fee scale patients. And we know that there is a major dental access challenge in serving those low-income patients. So similar to the kind of the immense pressures in nursing home employment, there are similar pressures in serving low-income dental patients. The program does have a retention effect. It's not as strong as in some of the other occupations because of those huge external forces that are also at work.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to open it up now for anyone in the gallery that would like to. Oh, I guess we have a list. Sorry. We'll start with Tricia Stark, who is the Minnesota Psychological Association. This will be followed by Shauna Rettmeyer, I think it's Rettmeyer, who is the Executive Director of Northwest Mental Health Center. Would you please come forward now, Shauna, so that we can take advantage of our time? And then, Tricia, as you've completed, if you'd step away, then Kate Dean can come forward from the Health Science and Medical Education Essential Health. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tricia Stark, and I represent the Minnesota Psychological Association. I just want to take this opportunity to thank Senator Claussen for his leadership on the Mental Health Workforce Summit and the Mental Health Workforce Report. The recommendations for loan forgiveness for mental health professionals who work in rural settings from those reports and reflected in this bill are critical, and I would urge you to support them. As you've heard before, 9 of 11 regions of Minnesota are designated as mental health workforce shortage areas, and loan forgiveness is an effective strategy to increase the workforce of these shortage areas so that critical services such as mental health crisis response teams and things like that can be filled and function effectively. Thank you.
I thank you for your direct and to-the-point presentation, Ms. Stark. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Shauna Rettmeyer. I'm the Executive Director for the Northwestern Mental Health Center in Crookston and just drove 5 hours to come here today to see you. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. As a rural and frontier community mental health provider, we serve Kitson, Marshall, Polk, Norman, Manoman, and Red Lake counties. We are approximately the same geographical size of the state of New Jersey. However, the difference with that is New Jersey has about 1,200 people per square mile, and we have 8. Because of that, of the rural and frontier nature of our region, and as the primary mental health safety net provider for very chronic mental health patients, finding qualified professionals and retaining them has been a challenge. Even though we have been successful with the National Health Services Corps in that loan repayment program, that also poses its own limits. And this bill has the opportunity to fill the gap where those programs lack at this time. For example, allowing mental health professionals to provide services in school-based settings or within the community where individuals live in their home. being able to provide additional telehealth services under this program, along with expanding the educational institutions that qualify for individuals to be eligible for this program. The success and recovery of individuals with mental health issues requires the provision of services to be located where they have access to those services. And for those, that means where they live. It means how much gas they can put in their vehicle in order to get to those services, or providing those services to where our children reside most of their time, and that's in their schools. The Northwestern Mental Health Center and the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs supports this bill, and thank Senator Claussen for introducing it. This can bring needed resources to our rural and frontier communities like Northwest Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Ms. Reitmeier, is it?
Reitmeier.
And I want to say especially thank you for bringing the voice of that part of the state to the Minnesota Capitol. And I heard what you said, that you drove 5 hours to come here to have a very brief time to tell your story. And I'm hoping that if there are questions for you at the end, that we'll have time for you to tell more.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Kate Dean. And would Jean Anderson from the Dental Hygiene Educators please approach? Please begin and introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Kate Dean. I'm the Director of Health Science and Medical Education at Essentia Health. And I thank you and the committee for the opportunity to speak today. I have submitted my comments in more detail that you should have in your packets, and in the interest of time, I'll be very brief. This addresses workforce issues that are very important to Essentia Health. We are an integrated healthcare system that has a strong presence in rural northern Minnesota. We applaud and support a loan forgiveness program designed to encourage healthcare professionals to practice in rural Minnesota communities. We do ask that the committee consider the inclusion of general surgery residents in this proposed program. There is a serious need for general surgeons in rural communities. The Minnesota Rural Health Advisory Committee's 2011 report stated that there were only 23 general surgeons practicing in rural Minnesota counties. Additionally, about half of those surgeons were going to retire in the next 6 to 10 years. So including general surgery residents in this loan forgiveness program helps us sustain a rural health care delivery system. Also, as we grow our healthcare workforce, finding clinical training opportunities is becoming increasingly difficult. This bill can help us increase training capacity because it is linking eligibility for the loan forgiveness program to a teaching requirement for several of the professions. While we support this in spirit, we would like the committee to consider dialogue around two areas of concern. First, it is our belief that there is a significant need to increase the number of clinical training site instructors. We propose specifically identifying clinical placement teaching rather than general teaching hours as eligibility criteria for the program. Second, in our experience, both healthcare systems and academic institutions prefer that providers have been in practice for 2 to 3 years before they take on a student to start teaching. Further discussion regarding how that teaching requirement can be supported in this proposed 3-year service obligation is recommended. Madam Chair, in closing, if there is an occasion to provide more detail or to engage in further conversation regarding this bill, Essentia Health welcomes the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sure, Senator Claussen, that you'll have these conversations, and would you like to speak to this at this time?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. For your information, we do have a second bill that will address some of Ms. Dean's comments that she made. So you'll be getting that shortly.
And so the issues in the second bill related to preceptor and training,
preceptors,
teaching,
clinical sites, and expanding residency slots throughout the state.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And Ms. Anderson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jean Anderson. I'm on the faculty at the University of Minnesota Dental School, and I also represent the Minnesota Dental Hygienist Educators Association. I'm here to support the addition of the advanced dental therapists and dental therapists in the bill, but I also would like to point out to the committee that there's an essential preventive specialist missing, and that is dental hygienists, and in particular, dental hygienists who are allowed to practice with limited authorization according to 150A.10 subdivision 1A, which allows dental hygienists with a collaborative management agreement, much like the advanced dental therapist, to practice without the supervision of a dentist on site. So a similar situation. And they provide services that really no other oral health care provider can with their periodontal therapeutic services as well as preventive emphasis. I'd also like to point out their debt incurred, especially for a bachelor degree program, ranges from $27,000 to up to $75,000 for a four-year program. In addition, we seem to think that, and we know that dental hygienists have trouble getting jobs, so it seems like there aren't a need for them in rural areas or in underserved areas, but that is really incorrect in that we need to provide and create opportunities in new places, and a collaborative practice hygienist with limited authorization can do just that. So I would encourage you to think about adding dental hygienists and particularly limited authorization hygienists to this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm certain that Senator Claussen is including that. I do remember the hearings. We were, many of us here, on the hearings that developed this expanded role for dental hygienists. It was very specific to meeting some of the need in the underserved communities, and the research and the data demonstrating competency as well as safety were substantial. So I encourage you that if there is a reason for restricting them, it can't be based on competency or ability to work within their scope of practice. Okay, that concludes our list of testifiers. I'll just check and see if there's anyone else. Seeing none, would somebody like to move Senator Claussen's bill for him, Senate File 3? There is a quorum present.
I'll move it.
Senator Marty moves Senate File 3 for Senator Claussen and refers it, I think, to higher education is the first stop. Any further discussion? Well, thank you very much for your testimony. We really did a nice job of doing this within the time we'd allotted. I know. I just wanted to say thanks before we took the vote. Appreciate it very much. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Okay, we are now moving forward. Thank you very much. The next bill in front of us is Senator Eakin's bill, Senate File 63. This is the medical assistance coverage for licensed independent clinical social worker consultations and authorizations. Welcome to the committee. I see that you have with you perhaps Sarah Anderson, who is a licensed independent clinical social worker with the Licensed Clinical Social Worker Society. And so please introduce yourselves as you present your testimony. And please move your conversation to the hallway. I would appreciate it because it's hard for us to hear in this room.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 63 is a bill to provide reimbursement for the licensed independent clinical social workers for consultation to primary care practitioners regarding mental health treatment for their clients. Psychologists can be reimbursed for consultation to primary care providers, and this would simply add them to the list as well of those professionals who would be reimbursed. And this is being done really basically out of fairness. They should also, they're providing similar services. They should be provided with reimbursement just as others are. And it's also, in the end, about the treatment of the patients, making sure that they're given the quality treatment that they deserve. And the licensed independent clinical social workers do provide expertise in mental health and diagnosis, health, psychology, interdisciplinary planning and care, case management, and a clinical treatment planning, all of which can be both very useful to primary practitioners and also necessary additions to treatment and medications. So, again, it comes down to the best treatment for the patients and also fairness for those providing this care. And with me today, as you've already said, Madam Chair, Sarah Anderson is here to testify, who is a licensed social worker.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and the committee, my name is Sarah Anderson. I am a licensed independent clinical social worker. I am the legislative chair for the Minnesota Society for Clinical Social Workers and a past president of the society as well. And I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate File 63, which would offer consultation reimbursement for clinical social workers. And clinical social workers provide a wide variety of mental health care, including assessment and diagnosis, as well as ongoing treatment. We currently provide significant amount of consultation with primary care providers because it's in the best interest of our clients. When necessary, we need to reach out to the interdisciplinary team members and have a team of people treat a client that is in need of qualified interdisciplinary team care. In doing so, this Senate File 63 would encourage not only others to expand this to help the quality of care for the clients that we treat, but it would also offer fairness and reimbursement for our time. We currently do this because it's best for our clients, and it costs us a significant amount of time, given there's other mental health professionals that are reimbursed for this service. It would be fair for licensed independent clinical social workers to be reimbursed as well.
Thank you very much. Another testifier. Was this someone that you'd asked to come, Senator, or is this the conclude your testimony on the bill?
This concludes my testimony.
Thank you.
I understood that there was maybe an amendment as well.
Yes, there's another person to testify, but if this is completing your portion of the testimony, then I would open it up for questions here among the members of the committee. Senator Hoffman and Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Egan, for bringing this forward. Anytime you can bring something that clearly has a need in Minnesota, I think it's well worth it. And with that, too, I'd like to, and I know you've talked with the folks, the licensed marriage and family therapists, and I'd like to bring amendment, I believe it's an A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
The A1 amendment is being distributed. Would you like to help us understand the contents of the amendment, Senator Hoffman?
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, there are 1,578 marriage family therapists, licensed marriage family therapists, that are licensed in Minnesota. To obtain a license to practice the marriage family therapy, individuals must graduate from an accredited master's or doctoral program, and then they complete the minimum of 2 years, 4,000 hours of postgraduate supervised practicum. They are just as well informed and to be practitioners and mental health providers. And I think adding them to the clause just opens up that level of support to families even broader than what exists. So that's how I explained it.
Okay, thank you very much. Would you like to speak to the amendment, Senator Egan?
And Madam Chair, I think this is a good amendment, so I consider it a friendly amendment. I too think that they should be included in this.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion on the amendment? Senator Nelson.
Thank you. I have a question, in a sense, to the amendment. The bill language in Senate File 63 says that this is for psychiatric consultation to primary care practitioners. And so my question is adding a licensed marriage and family therapist, does that fall under psychiatric consultation?
Is there someone?
Licensed marriage, family, and therapists are listed as a mental health professional as well and able to provide the diagnosis and treatment for mental disorders. So they would be under the same category as psychiatrists, psychologists, advanced nurse specialists, clinical social workers, and LMFTs would be included in that as well.
Thank you. That was my question. So as long as they fall under that same category, and I see Ms. White might have a question about that.
Ms. White?
Madam Chair and members, under the definition of mental health professional, It does include marriage and family. Must be a marriage and family therapist with at least 2 years of postmaster's supervised experience in the delivery of clinical services and the treatment of mental illness. So it's not as broad as it is in the amendment.
So then my suggestion would be to amend this amendment to include that further clarification as Ms. White read, and I'm wondering if Senator Hoffman would look at that as a friendly amendment.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, if it doesn't change the scope, and you know, I'm a sociologist, I'm not a licensed marriage family. If it doesn't change the scope or the intent of what we wanted to get to, which is providing those services to much needed families and folks out there, then absolutely I'll accept it. Does that, and if maybe that's a question to Ms. White.
Senator Rosen, and then we're going to get some clarification here from counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This was my bill that we passed last year, and to broaden it from psychologist, and we added the advanced practice registered nurse along with that. And I think Ms. Anderson made a very good point about making sure that there is a multidisciplinary team that's involved. I would encourage that this be looked at, because you could start adding a whole bunch of job descriptions on here without making sure that there's that continuum of care. We want to make sure that, you know, we're getting right to the problem and that we do have a good team set up. So that's why I resisted last year broadening it too much, because there had not been that discussion at that point. But I agree with the clinical social worker. I just need a little more clarification for the licensed marriage family therapist, because that does seem to be quite broad.
May I suggest that we listen again to Ms. White? She's going to describe this language related to family. Licensed marriage and family therapists also applies to licensed social workers in the definitions that we have for mental health worker. Is that the term that we're defining here? Professional mental health workers. So what I think we need to do is make reference to this language that documents the educational requirements for the position that we're talking about.
Yes, that would get to my amendment.
That would be your recommendation as well, Senator?
Yes,
Nelson?
That would get to my what I hope would be considered a friendly amendment.
Yes. So if you would prepare that as a friendly amendment to Senator Hoffman's amendment, I will ask Senator Hoffman to speak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will go back to original. You know, Senator Eakin did say the amendment I brought forward was a friendly amendment, but with the addition of the friendly amendment that's now on the friendly amendment, if it doesn't change the scope and if it helps clarify things, then I'll accept the friendly amendment on the friendly amendment.
Okay. Very good. Now we have only one amendment.
Senator Eakin. And somebody just stepped forward as a licensed marriage and family therapist. Is that correct?
Or I'm a marriage and family therapist. Yes.
And Casey McGraw.
Would you please say your name and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Casey McGraw, and I'm a marriage and family therapist and co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Association of Marriage and Family Therapists. MFTs are trained and practice as systemic and relational mental health professionals. We work across disciplines that includes primary care doctors and practitioners for the benefit of our clients and communities. We don't work outside of our scope of practice, but we do work with social workers, doctors, psychiatrists across the board. We appreciate being included in this bill and want to thank both the social workers, Senator Hoffman for adding the amendment, and Senator Eakin for bringing this important issue forward.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. White, could you articulate Senator Hoffman's amendment at this time to Senator Eakin's bill?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. What I would do for purposes of narrowing the scope of the licensed independent clinical social worker and the licensed marriage and family therapist so they fall under the definition of mental health professional, would add a cross-reference to that statute, which is 245.462, subdivision 18, And for the social worker, it's paragraph 2. And for the marriage and family therapist, it's paragraph 5.
So the motion will be to, for the amendment, is to add, as is indicated in Senators Hoffman's A1 amendment, licensed marriage and family therapist, but also some qualifying language that indicates that each, the licensed independent clinical social worker falls under 245.46 subdivision 18 paragraph 2, and the licensed marriage family therapist under paragraph 5, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
5. Senator Lurie.
And Madam Chair, maybe we ought to give counsel the ability to fix this up to make sure that this narrowing only applies to the LCSWs and the marriage and family therapists. Because we have a clarifying clause that's going to apply to two of these five or so professions. I wasn't convinced we had it quite right there, but I'd like to give counsel the ability to make sure it says what we're all agreeing we are talking about, I think.
Okay, we'll we will set our action aside on this for right now, and I'll see if it can be done fairly quickly.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you. While they're doing that, maybe I could ask the question that I had, actually, before the amendment, actually.
Okay, is this a question for Senator Egan?
Yes, it is,
okay,
actually.
Go ahead.
Or perhaps as testifier. I was just curious about the word independent in defining the clinical social worker, and I'm sure there's a reason for that. I'd just like to know what it is, and my concern is, does it exempt, then, social workers who might be working with a particular group? And so I want to know, why is that word independent in there? What are you trying to accomplish with that?
The word independent goes towards our licensure, which is statutes under the Board of Social Work. A licensed independent clinical social worker has received that licensure after they have completed a master's degree, completed 360 core credits in clinical education, also had the same standard with other mental health professionals for education, supervision, practice, and practicum. We, mental health professionals basically, in I think it was 2011, standardized the education to make sure that everybody met the bar in order to safely treat individuals. So the word independent goes for our licensure, meaning I'm an LICSW, so I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker. That's what the term is under the licensure for the Board of Social Work. There's other, that's the term. Federally, sometimes we're L, the word independent isn't in there, but for the state of Minnesota, it is.
So just to follow. So,
yes, Senator Nelson.
So are there any licensed clinical social workers, then, that are not independent? It's just part of the title?
Correct.
Thank you. That answers my question, if that's the case.
Okay, Madam Chair. Are you ready, Ms. White?
Madam Chair.
Yes, excuse me. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not to mess up this whole discussion, but I also picked up what a mental health professional is, and it does say, of course, the psychiatrist and the clinical psychologist, school psychologist, clinical social worker, licensed professional counselor, mental health counselor, certified alcohol drug abuse counselor, nurse, psychotherapist, marital and family therapist, pastoral counselor, and peer specialist. And my point is, are we just piecemealing this? And should we have a broader discussion about what should be covered with this MA issue? Because I could see it. I could see, you know, another amendment coming and another amendment coming. So that's all. It's just a broader question about what is the true purpose.
I think the essence of what you're saying, Senator Rosen, is that there will be continual requests to expand who's covered under MA, and mm-hmm. There may need to be a discussion about that. I think that it's a matter of whether or not you agree that these are qualified persons. We'd have to Is there a reason other than the fact that each time we expand the definition of who's eligible for this funding, that we expand access to medical assistance resources, and then there is a financial impact of that? Mm-hmm. So in some ways, as we do in all things, we contain that by restricting who has access to this kind of coverage. So that, besides the competency, is going to be the challenge for the Finance Committee, mm-hmm. to determine whether or not, in fact, we can afford to do this expansion at this time. Mm-hmm. But for us, I think the question is whether or not we want, that's in front of us now, we can vote yes or no, is whether or not to add these two professions to being eligible for MA. And Senator, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to kind of throw in a red herring, I guess. The one who does the most consultation with the doctors related to their orders and their medications, et cetera, is the registered nurse. And that is the one person who cannot bill MA. And so to me, it seems rather absurd that that's excluded. Right now, the community programs in mental health are, they get a grant from the county to fund their nurses, and because they can't bill for them. And I think it's something we should consider in the future.
Was there? I'm sorry. I am consulting with staff, our legal staff, on the amendment. So, if there was a question for me, I missed it, Senator Eakin.
I was just bringing up, Madam Chair, the issue that the one who does the most consultation is the nurse, and especially in community mental health, and they are not billable under MA, and it seems absurd that they're excluded from that process. Right now, nurses are funded through a granting process through the counties and are constantly at risk of being defunded.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It seems this we might need to establish maybe a task force.
Study group.
To take a look at this issue, because there appears to be a lot of folks that want to get in on or that legitimately want to bill and do the work for the patient, and maybe we should, I mean, not to derail your bill, Senator Eakin, but really maybe we should establish a task force to talk about who works with the patients and what do they do and how should they be billed.
Senator Rosen, and then Senator Nelson.
I have this short-term memory. I remember why we tried to keep it. to what we did, the advanced practice nurse and mental health and the psychologist and psychiatrist, because they can prescribe medication.
Oh.
All the other
psychologists are not able to prescribe medication, Senator Rosen.
No. Anyway, please go on. Senator Rosen, you need to be acknowledged in order to present, please.
Okay,
so Senator Nelson.
That was short-term memory.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
This dialogue actually kind of gets back to my first question, which had to do with the title, which was psychiatric consultation. And so then as I look it up here and look at and read that entire subdivision, it seems that the qualifying parameter is that they be certified in psychiatric mental health. And that kind of is the point that I'm trying to get at with as we look at expanding this to very important licensures. My question is, does it fall under the psychiatric consultation? That's really the gist of my original question, and it's clearer now as I look at the full statute on this.
I think there are a couple of questions in front of us. Whether or not you want to move ahead at all with the expansion with this without a broader discussion about the expansion, because there are a number of professionals who might, in a piecemeal way, come forward making this request. The second issue on the table, I think, is answered by the addition to the amendment, which defines that clearly, that competency is there in the area of mental health in order to meet the criteria for eligibility for MA. So that piece of it, I think, is answered. Is that correct, Ms. White?
I think so, Madam Chair. But I am not sure if consultation related to mental health is equivalent to psychiatric consultation. And the two categories of people that they're adding to this statute with the qualifying cross-reference that I recommended, they're defined under mental health professional, but I'm just not sure if that's equivalent
Madam Chair.
To psychiatric consultation.
Yes, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to say that I support moving forward on this bill. I think the issue is, as we've moved out of the hospital and into community mental health, there's a lot of people who are left out of the whole process and the billing system. And as we work on that, I think it's good that we start adding people so they're more included in the team, and because it's otherwise we don't get that matching money from the feds. And I really want to encourage the advancement of more community mental health, and I think this.
Okay, I think that to move us forward, because we have another bill in front of us, I think that we will offer the amendment of Senator Hoffman's, and members of the committee can vote for it, against it, for the various reasons that you may have about not being satisfied, for example, that the issues of concern have been adequately met, or that you think there should be a broader discussion, or you think that we can move ahead with this and pick up a broader discussion at another time. So I'll leave that to you to decide how you want to vote on this bill at this time, unless, Senator, you would like to have it tabled for a while and have a little further conversation. I'd let you make the call on that if you want to take a risk on the vote right now.
And Madam Chair, I'd prefer to move forward with a vote on it at this point. And I do agree that I think there needs to be a larger discussion about this issue. I don't know if we need to go as far as a task force, but as Senator Hayden was suggesting, I do think that we need to have a larger discussion on this. But I don't think that should stop this particular bill from moving forward. These professionals have come forward asking for this legislation, and certainly the other areas that would affect or that could possibly be included, they could come forward too at another point in time. But
okay, thank you. I think we have to move now to a vote, and people have their reasons for their vote at this time. Senator Eno.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarity's sake, are we voting on the A1 as printed or with the additional language that was referenced earlier?
We are about to hear Senator Hoffman's amendment to Senate file, to the amendment, the A1 amendment. So what we're going to be voting on now is the amendment, or did you incorporate this?
Madam Chair, I agreed to the friendly on the friendly, okay. And then we recessed, or not recessed, but then Senator Lori and Ms. White got something. So my assumption, Madam Chair,
this will
is
be
that
the A1.
Would be, yeah.
This is the now the A1 amendment as articulated by Ms. White. Please.
Madam Chair and members, on page 1, line 3, after worker, insert comma, as defined in 245.462, comma, subdivision 18, comma, paragraph 2. And after therapist, insert as defined in 245.462, subdivision 18, paragraph 5.
Thank you. Is everyone clear?
That's good.
Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the A1 amendment as clarified, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. It passes. And now to the Senator Hoffman, would you like to move the bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move this bill.
It's Senate File 63, pass and be referred to finance.
As amended
and referred to finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, now we're moving to our final bill. Thank you very much for your efficiency. We now have Senate File 100, Senator Peterson. It's the Right to Try Act. With Senator Peterson is
Craig Hanslick from the Goldwater Institute. And there's also a request from Catherine Kemet. Kemet, and if you would be willing to come up expeditiously, we have about 10 minutes and or maybe less, maybe 5 minutes for presentation if you would like to allow the committee a chance to really have conversation with you about the issue.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the page, I do have a handout for the members. Yeah. I'll be brief. Members, before you, Senate File 100, the Right to Try Act. The Right to Try Act allows terminally ill patients who have exhausted traditional methods of treatment to utilize investigational or trial drugs that have been through FDA's the first phase of FDA approval, which has to do with safety and dosage primarily. It isn't by any means a silver bullet or comprehensive approach, and certainly will affect a narrow band of people, but a considerable number in a considerable way, and provides an avenue for folks who maybe have hit a dead end in terms of their treatment and are facing, a terminal diagnosis. In the interest of time, Madam Chair, I will just turn over to the testifier, our guest, and get on with it.
Are there some amendments that you'd like to introduce to us before we begin the conversation so we know what it is that we're going to be acting on?
First, I have the A2 amendment.
Would someone offer the A2 amendment for Senator?
Offer the A2.
Senator Benson offers the A2 amendment. Would you please articulate what we're looking at here?
So this is language that is the result of working with the Minnesota Medical Association and the health plans. Talking about liability and basically reassuring everybody that nobody is required to participate in the program, and also, like I said, deals with liability around their business interests, as well as you see Subdivision 8, clarifying that we're not creating a private cause of action for individuals who may participate in the program.
Is there any other amendment or change to the bill?
I do have another amendment, the A3 amendment as well.
Okay. So a motion has been made to accept the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The amendment passes. We are now looking at the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A3 amendment is a slight change to the terminal illness definition. There was some concern from MMA about kind of the open or vague language about terminal and what terminal means. And, of course, they articulated that everybody's terminal in one sense or another. And so we wanted to provide clarity that there's some imminent terminal diagnosis. And so that's what the language does.
Senator Benson offers the A3 amendment. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. It passes. Okay, please begin your by presenting your name and your testimony to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Craig Hanslick. I'm from the Goldwater Institute, and I'm here to just talk to you a little bit about what Right to Try is and those folks that would be affected by it. The current state of the FDA's Compassionate Use Program is overly cumbersome for patients and requires 100 to 150 hours of physician paperwork time in addition to 100 to 150 hours of manufacturer paperwork time. 100 to 150 hours is roughly 2.5 weeks at a 40-hour work week, and it's tough to find a doctor that's willing to set aside that time for one patient to complete the paperwork. What Right to Try would do is eliminate the bureaucracy involved with petitioning the FDA for approval and allow a patient and a doctor directly to ask the manufacturer of an investigational medication, which has passed the first phase of the FDA's clinical safety trials process. They could ask the drug company directly for access to that medication. Again, the medication would have to be through the FDA's first phase of testing, which is the safety phase, and still ongoing. I'd like to share a story with you of Diego Morris, who is a 14-year-old kid from Phoenix, Arizona, who was diagnosed a few years ago with osteosarcoma, which is a bone cancer. In this case, it was in his leg. He had exhausted all of his available options here in the United States, and his parents were told that essentially he was going to die soon, and there was nothing else that they could do for him. His parents, being resourceful folks that they are, they found out that a medication used to treat osteosarcoma in kids was available and approved for use in Europe. And so they uprooted their entire family, moved to Europe, and got the treatment that Diego needed. He is now cancer-free, and I saw him actually and his mother 2 days ago. He's, you know, a happy 14-year-old kid playing soccer on the weekends. That drug that he received in Europe is still not available for folks to use in the United States. And so what this would do is allow folks like Diego and his family to utilize a medication that in other countries, in other circumstances, has been approved for use and is currently in ongoing trials here in the United States at home without causing a family to have to uproot and move. So that's essentially what it does.
Okay. Thank you very much. I would like to turn it over to the next testifier. Would you introduce yourself? And I just would like you testifiers to give us your critical messages. I would love to have the committee have a chance to talk with Senator Peterson about his bill, and we're nearly out of time.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'll be brief. My name is Catherine Kmit. I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which is the trade association of Minnesota's 7 nonprofit health plans. And I thank you for the opportunity to provide comments on Senate File 100. We did have the opportunity to meet with Senator Peterson yesterday and had a very good visit. We've been working to understand the scope and impact of this bill, and we have some questions and concerns. As the testifier indicated, there is an FDA process that is available, and we're in the process of trying to understand how this bill differs from what already exists today. We are also reviewing the bill to understand how it will work from a practical standpoint. For example, how does a patient actually obtain the drug or device? In addition to paying for experimental drugs and procedures that are not FDA approved, there is a medical management issue that makes it important to know if a patient is seeking care and whether there is potential for drug interactions that may cause more pain and suffering or actually hasten death. This bill is a clear example of the need to give providers the ability to share clinically appropriate data, information with each other for things like drug interactions and care management purposes. In these situations, it is particularly important that providers work together to manage the care and the condition of their patients. We appreciate the language in the A2 and A3 amendments. We believe these changes help clarify the author's intent. We continue to study this bill, and we'll be working with Senator Peterson as the bill moves through the legislative process. We appreciate the opportunity to be on the record, and thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much. We also have Nick Rolls, who has requested to be heard. I guess he's not here. Okay, so we have a question from Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Peterson, actually just two questions. And page 2, line 12, a manufacturer may require an eligible patient to pay the costs associated with manufacturing the investigational drug. Can you tell me how that's going to work? I mean, is that something that they can set a price and the patient pays it? I mean, it seems somewhat.
So, yeah, Madam Chair,
Senator
Rosen, the impetus of that language and a lot of the other language that you see is to not require anybody necessarily to participate in the program. So, by providing resources to pay for it or otherwise. This is to give people an option, and if they're willing to pursue that option, they have to provide for the means to do so.
So, Senator Rosen. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Peterson, the manufacturer must have a list of the cost. There's got to be some accountability coming from the manufacturer as far as how much this medication costs. I would assume. That's something perhaps needs a little more clarification.
Yeah, sure.
Going through Commerce, perhaps.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the intent of that language
is
to...
Mr. Hanslick is speaking.
Thank you. The intent of that language is to allow for a pharmaceutical company to charge for the cost that it would that they would accrue for making one dose for that patient. It's not meant to allow them to recoup all investigational research development costs that went into that drug.
Oh, I see. Okay. One more question. I'm sorry.
Yes, Senator Rosen, it's fine. And let me just follow up on that. There isn't anything in this bill, and it doesn't deal yet with putting restrictions on the pricing that company asks for that drug. That may be an issue at another time.
Right.
If you know you're not if a company is gouging these persons to get this drug at this point in their life, that may be something for another conversation. But it's not addressed in this bill. Is that correct, Senator Peterson?
We don't specifically place a cap on the cost. No. Yeah.
Senator Rosen, you had a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Peterson, I was just wondering if you've gotten an opinion from MDH on this, if they have an opinion on the Right to Try Act?
I have no opinion from formal opinion from MDH.
Okay.
I don't know if there's anyone here from the Department of Health. They may not have a formal position on this, but if you do, please come forward. Process. Seeing no one, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then
Chair.
Senator Marty. And then Senator Benson.
My concern, Senator Peterson, is the this looks like this would be an option for those with money. I don't see any opportunity for anybody who is poor to access this, unless I'm missing that language.
The gentleman has some experience in other states. He'd speak to that.
Okay, please, Mr. Hanslick.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton. The current situation that we have now with compassionate use and the clinical trial process really also just benefits those with resources. A lot of the time, especially in rural states like Minnesota can be, folks who are admitted into clinical trials, usually that clinical trial is not happening anywhere near their home. In a lot of the instances, it's not happening at all, even in their state. We had one patient, in the interest of time, I'll make it quick, but a patient in southern Arizona who was accepted to a clinical trial in Northern California. She was precisely who you're referring to. She did not have a lot of resources to devote to her treatment, and she pooled her resources together and tried to make it back and forth from southern Arizona to Northern California over the course of 3 or 4 weeks, and it just ended up being too much for her to bear and her family, and she passed away. What Right to Try would do for folks that have limited resources would bring essentially the clinical trial medication to them and their physician at their hospital.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, a couple of things. One, in response to Senator Eaton, I think a lot of cases, the language on the costs, I think a lot of cases the manufacturers want more uses for the drugs and will be supplying them in some of these. I think that's the reality of what is likely to happen. Number two, I understand the labeling this the Right to Try Act. I don't mind the advocates call it that. I just think we put everything in statute, right to know, right to try, right to this. And I'm going to move to strike subdivision one. And then I also have concern about the amendment we just passed to A3, and I was talking with Senator Benson, and I'll leave it to her to decide. But we both had concerns. The language there seems to be, I think there's some problems with that language. But I'll move to strike subdivision one, just because I think it's okay to call it that. I just don't think we need that in statute.
Madam Chair, I don't object if that's the will of the committee to strike subdivision one. That's fine.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. That's sort of the history of the committee. So everyone is clear on the amendment? All those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. Passes. Senator Benson, did you have a recommendation?
Madam Chair, I have a comment about the amendment and then a question. The amendment, well, I did move it. It moved rather quickly. And so in out of respect for the committee's time, I'm not going to move to strike the language, but Senator Peterson, the word soon is very vague, imminent, so I'm seeking the right word, don't have time to find it. And then without life-sustaining procedures, if you're in kidney failure, dialysis is a life-sustaining procedure, and I don't think we mean kidney failure to be a terminal illness. And so I think this just needs a little work. I would be happy to work on it before you get to judiciary, and I can find somebody on judiciary to work on that. I just wanted to be clear with the committee. There's some vagueness to the language that we're moving. To my question, why phase one, not phase two? FDA.
Senator Peterson.
So, I guess to first speak to the A3 amendment and how we arrived at that language is that we worked on that a bit with MMA. There's a problem with creating exact times, you know, whether it be 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. It's never really appropriate to pick a definite time because the conditions are different inherently. And so, but they also didn't want it to be open-ended, like I said, where you just say terminal and that's all you say because, as I mentioned, sort of with tongue-in-cheek at the outset, everybody is to some degree terminal. And so we tried to use language that was common in other legislatures that, and this is sort of where we ended up. And you know, so to the point about why phase one and not phase two and other parts of that continuum, one is time, right? It takes a long time, and it's a long process. It can take 10 years to get 10 to 15 years to get through the FDA approval process, and the more you add to that, the more you slow it down, and a lot of times folks with terminal diagnosis, you know, that's a premium on time. And phase one is a critical phase, though, however, when it comes to safety and dosage. So phase two has to do with efficacy and side effects, and so the determinations are a bit less critical, especially when you're already facing the most critical diagnosis, which is the terminal diagnosis, that you're willing to take some chances on some of those other parts of the FDA approval process.
Madam Chair, could I add one quick note?
Yes, you can, if it's brief.
Yes, Senator Benson.
Mr. Hanslick.
Thank you. The only thing I would add to that is that the medication going through phase one and into phase two and on to phase three is identical. There's been no development whatsoever within that medication. It's the same exact formula going through the entire thing.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, as you work in judiciary on the new A3 amendment, I think the problem is that with life-sustaining procedures, I'm not as precise in terms of whether it's 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months, or whatever, making it terminal. But I do think when you define it without life-sustaining procedures, well, a lot of illnesses would be medical treatment would be life-sustaining in effect. I think it's diabetes. I think this is not the best language. I'm not sure what it is, and I think between you and MMA and others, I think we can do better than this.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm happy.
Yes,
to
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I'm happy to work on the language. I hope the intent is clear, and that we're just trying to work out the technical language so that it meets the intent of what we're trying to do.
Thank you, and I'll just add my comment to this. You know, I have an interest, as you know, in you being successful with this. But my reaction to this language is that there has to be time for the treatment. There has to be time left in the person's life in order for an intervention to have a chance of working. So you don't want to tighten it down so much that the probability of the alternative having the time that's needed for intervention exists. So the language is important. I understand what the issue is in terms of not having somebody initiate something too early, but we also don't want to tighten it down so much that it doesn't really allow for effectiveness.
Madam Chair, you hit the nail on the head, and that's why we ended up with what you could describe as vague language, because it's almost impossible to nail down an appropriate timeline in all, you know, that universally applies to every mm-hmm. situation.
Okay, so I think we are going to need to wrap it up, and the motion would be, would anybody like to offer the Senator Hoffman offers. Senate file number 63, or 100, excuse me, be passed as amended and be referred to judiciary. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes, and thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
We're adjourned.
That was very interesting.
You were laughing.
All right, we got through it. Sometimes they put me to sleep.